this year we're doing things a little bit different. We thought if one meteorologist is great, two must be better. So we're doubling our meteorologist pleasure today. And we invited someone you're very familiar with who has been to, how many of these have you been to, Ed? 10, 12?
This is the 16th year, and therefore it's my 14th. I missed a couple along the way for out-of-town reasons, so...
So yep.
14th so, all day.
So you know what Ed Kieser looks like, but now you're saying, well, who is that other fellow over there? And his name is Mark Russo, and Mark actually has a long-time relationship with the radio station along with John Davis. Currently, they're at Chesapeake Energy out of Chicago, Illinois, but they had been on the radio at AM 580 at other positions along the way. How many years have you been on the radio, Mark?
Oh, I've been on the radio, I believe, 8 years now.
8 years. So, well...
Time flies.
And your hairline isn't receding yet?
Not quite yet. Oh. Thankfully, I have my mother's hair rather than my father's hair.
So 8 years. And they do our agricultural weather every Monday afternoon at about 2:32 Central Time, and go 4, 5, 6 minutes talking about weather conditions across Illinois, Indiana, the Midwest, as well as other growing areas around the world regarding crops. And what I thought I would do is this. I'm going to start with Mark, because Mark is the rookie. Yeah. And first an observation, Mark. Actually, I'm going to pat you on the back. And I'm going to do that by saying that it is really difficult, if not doggone impossible, to come up with a halfway decent long-range forecast. And yet this winter, you and John came up with a doozy. And in some ways, it went contrary to what other people were saying. And as it turns out, I think, and Ed would say this true, what you were saying pretty much came to pass. So I guess the question I have for you, just as an opener, is what are the difficulties and challenges with trying to put something together that's longer out than 3 days?
Oh, wow. That certainly is a tough question, Dave. And, well, certainly forecasting, whether it's forecasting the weather, whether it's forecasting markets, whether it's forecasting what you plan on doing 10 days from now, it certainly is a challenge. Any kind of prediction is a challenge. But at least from a weather standpoint, what we do at Chesapeake Energy, both from an energy side of things and agriculture as well, too, is that what we do before going into the season is just, you know, sit down. Both myself and John Davis, we're the weather team, we're the weather department, just the two of us. But what we do is, and it's pretty much become a routine now, is just sit down prior to the season, just discuss the big picture variables that we think are important on dictating what weather trends are going to be, not only across North America or the Midwest, but across the whole world, just because your atmosphere, it's a global circulation. So what's happening on one side of the world can affect other areas of the world, and your atmosphere is just one big fluid of air that's just rotating around. And so what we do is come up with variables, what we think is going to be the most important for driving the weather patterns. And so, you know, some of these variables, which actually a lot of you are probably familiar with, or at least of some of them, your ENSO or your ENSO conditions, or your equatorial Pacific water temperatures, whether you're in a La Nina or whether you're in El Nino, that's one variable. But it seems like that variable sometimes gets overused, at least in our opinion, as far as dictating weather trends. But besides the whole El Niño-La Niña oscillation, we look at sea surface temperatures across other areas of the globe, such as in the Atlantic oceans. We also look at Indian Ocean water temperatures to come up with some correlations, and then look at some kind of other big picture patterns here, or you know what happens over the even we do some statistical variables or statistical models, just taking you know what happens over the winter. Does that tend to get repeated over the summer, or vice versa? What's going on across the southern hemisphere summer, such as what you know weather patterns in Brazil and Argentina? Does that have any kind of correlation with patterns across the U.S. or other growing areas in North America? But what we do is put all these variables together and just come up with a forecast. And yeah, we certainly had success this past winter here, although, just to tell you, we were going for a warmer than normal winter here across North America, especially the Midwest here. But I'll tell you what, there were some sleepless nights there back early December in the midst of our severe cold wave, where you start questioning yourself there, and gosh, can you actually have a warmer than normal winter when you're sitting at 10 below zero? And certainly things changed there late in the month. And now we didn't expect a record warm January, the warmest January of all time, but certainly we were happy with what happened this past winter.
Well, what was, just quickly, what was one of the, or a couple of the factors that you looked at that made you think it was going to be a warm winter?
Well, one of the key features was actually water temperatures across both the North Pacific Oceans and the North Atlantic Oceans. We had a very warm bias of sea surface temperatures going into the winter season, especially through the fall and now and then on into the winter. Some of the warm sea surface temperatures in the Atlantic was one of the reasons why we had such an active hurricane season this past year. And we felt that that those two warm water areas were two of the key features. Another variable that we felt was important, not to get too technical or nerdy for you, is what we call angular momentum, or basically just which direction or how fast direction and movement of your jet stream patterns here across the world. And there are some signals going into this winter based on what we call angular momentum that were signaling a warmer temperature regime over the winter months.
At a year ago, we had a fairly wet winter, and we went into the growing season fairly fully charged, as it were, with both subsoil moisture and on-the-surface moisture levels. And I think that when we had our dry conditions across Illinois in July, it was partially that subsoil moisture as well as a couple of timely rains, key areas that pulled the corn crop through and made it produce better than many thought it had the possibility of producing. However, I wonder if we're going into 2006 as fully charged as we did in 2005. And as you're keeping an eye on things, is the word drought beginning to enter into your thoughts or language at all?
There's a lot to discuss there. You gave me a huge question, so I'll try to break it down a bit. First off, are we going into this season as well charged as last season? The answer is no. You may recall last year in January, we had some areas that had flooding rains and record-breaking rains. So we didn't have that this year. We're not going into the season with the same soil moisture that we had last year. But, of course, what's really most important is what happens as we go through the season more than the winter. As you noted, maybe because we had good subsoil moisture, that might have helped some crops do a little better in the dry areas than they would have otherwise if the subsoil was really, really depleted. But last season, we generally had a dry pattern over the Midwest during the summer months, the only exception being the very active tropical season, bringing up quite a bit of moisture into the Ohio Valley, southern and eastern Illinois, into Indiana and Ohio. And really, it was just a few key storms, starting with Arlene and Dennis and Katrina, even helping bring timely rains to make the crops in the areas further to the east respond well. And, of course, yields were much lower in northern and western Illinois and parts of Iowa and Missouri, but, as you noted, maybe a little better than what was expected because of the subsoil. But I do think going into the season, you have to look at the underlying dry conditions still to our west. However, the weather pattern here looks like it's changing a bit to a wetter weather pattern. In fact, rain will be moving in tonight, and some of those very dry areas of last summer are going to get the best rains they've had since last year coming up here over the next week, I think. So we are seeing a change of the weather pattern, so I'm not really concerned at this moment about drought. That's not to say there won't be problems with dryness this season, but I'm not going into the season saying, oh, because it's been dry, we're going to stay dry. In fact, the pattern is switching.
And I guess we'll go back to Mark and ask him about this La Nina that we're hearing so much about. And is there a La Nina? Is it a weakening La Nina over the last several weeks? Is it just as strong as it was? What's its status? And historically, what does it imply? Not that it means it will happen this year, but historically, what does it imply?
Well, where we stand right now is, yes, we are in a very weak La Nina. Basically, we're kind of straddling the neutral to La Nina category there with our Pacific sea surface temperatures. So technically, we're in a very weak La Nina. And certainly we developed this La Nina over the past couple of months. Now we have, as Dave mentioned here, is that we have weakened over the past couple of weeks. We've actually seen water temperatures warm across the equatorial Pacific Oceans, and so still we're at this very weak levels. And even kind of taking that further, at least as we go through the growing season here, now it's tough to say exactly where sea surface temperatures are going to be, but we would expect, or at least what we're expecting right now, is for this very weak La Nina to continue as we go through the growing season, maybe oscillating between neutral and then weak La Nina levels. But in general, we expect a weak La Nina here for the upcoming growing season. So, you know, what does this mean? Well, as I mentioned earlier, when we do our seasonal forecast, La Nina is just one variable of many variables. But if you just strictly look at the La Nina variable, what a La Nina here tends to lead to during the growing season is a relatively drier bias across the central and eastern U.S., which can at times lead to warmer than normal temperatures or at least some periodic heat. Obviously, periodic heat is kind of a normal situation during the summer, but if you are drier than normal throughout the summer season, then, you know, typically, you end up having above normal temperatures for the whole time frame of, you know, June, July, and August. So if you just strictly look at the La Nina variable, that at least increases the odds this upcoming growing season of some dryness and also above normal temperatures.
And does it also imply the potential for a wetter spring?
Gosh, Dave, once again, you're just asking the toughest questions here today here. Basically, from a spring precipitation standpoint, actually the best correlation is when you're in a very strong El Nino, because that typically produces wetter than normal conditions throughout the springtime. A weak La Nina really doesn't have much of a correlation, although when you look at least winter precipitation trends during a La Nina, you tend to have above normal precipitation in the Pacific Northwest, up into the northern plains in southwest Canada, drier than normal conditions across the southwest in like southern California, Arizona, New Mexico, which then extends out in the southern plains. And certainly that has come to fruition here over the past 3 months with the dryness that we're seeing in the hard red winter wheat belt there in the southern plains. But as you go in the spring, just your atmosphere just typically becomes more conducive for rainfall as your temperatures warm up. So really from a weak La Nina standpoint, there's really no correlation here with any kind of trends for this upcoming spring rainy season.
We have a question in the room.
Yeah. Concerning products that producers can use, I look at the Palmer Drought Index and the NOAA Drought Monitor. What kind of confidence do you have in those products? Is it something you use to compile some of your information? And are there other suggestions you would have for producers to monitor this kind of climatic information?
Ed, go ahead and start that.
The drought monitor basically is monitoring where there is drought. So that's more of what's going on right now. So obviously that's very useful. I think sometimes the drought forecasts that come out are not always as accurate. And basically when you get into, say, a dry situation, they have about a 2 out of 3 chance of verifying if they say it's going to continue to be dry, because if you have near average or below average rainfall, then they're right. The only way it reverses is if it gets wetter than average, and I've seen the forecast go wrong before. And I think that's the one thing that for those of you that make decisions, you have to weigh the odds, and that's why a lot of the outlooks you see now just tilt the odds one way or another from average, a little bit above average or a little below average, because you can't put all your eggs in one basket. So the products that say what's going on right now, I use those that make forecasts. I kind of sometimes take with a grain of salt.
Well, at least with what we use, honestly, we look at the Palmer Drought Index or the drought monitoring tool, but we don't really rely heavily on it, just because it seems like it's more focused for hydrological purposes, which can obviously affect agriculture, but it incorporates both long-term and short-term precipitation trends and temperatures, and kind of it's a quick thing to look at, but we don't think it at least is extremely reliable, at least from a producer's standpoint, just because it almost tells you what you already know, as far as whether you've been in here in Illinois, especially with much of northern Illinois or the northern half in the drought category. We all kind of know that, or at least those from the area, just because we just witnessed it. But that doesn't quite tell you, as Ed had mentioned, what lies ahead here, and it's really the key, what lies ahead and what's going to happen here throughout the growing season. Just because you're dry right now doesn't mean that you're going to remain dry. That's why we grow our crops here in the Midwest. It's such a favorable climate, and it's a rare thing to have any kind of really long-term extreme drought. And it doesn't happen too often, but certainly from a drought outlook or a drought monitoring tool, it's something pretty, but nothing that I think that everyone doesn't already know already.
Well,
I was just going to add one thing to that. The forecast that they put out, again, another problem I mentioned, they have a 2 out of 3 chance of being correct. So oftentimes I feel the drought forecast is a lot of times what we call a persistence forecast.
Yeah.
And so it's not very good when there is a change in weather pattern. So a lot of those forecasts are already based on what is already happening and not really, I think, looking at the atmosphere enough to what's going to come in later.
Well, then, in addition to listening to AM 580 and going to our website, willag.org, what tool, Mark, would you use then that these producers can get a handle on that might be better than the drought monitor?
Well, actually, one of the tools that we use, and I believe it is, I believe it is free, is the Midwestern Regional Climate Center. They show Midwest precipitation charts, what rainfall is like over the past 30 days, over the last 60 days, over the last 90 days. That's actually what we look at. There's other centers out there that provide similar information. But if you go to the Midwestern Regional Climate Center's website, I believe you can navigate to it.
I think it's mcc.sws.uiuc.edu.
Yes.
One more time, a little slower.
Okay, I don't think there's a www in front, if I recall. It's just mcc.sws for State Water Survey, .uiuc, University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, .edu. Steve Hilberg will certainly give you that.
We'll ask him what his website name is on the air. You have a question back there, Todd?
Yes. My question is, so much of this rally in the underlying strength of the market has been to the drought in the hard red wheat country. Do you think that dry weather pattern is going to persist in that area? And the second part of my question is, do those of us in the Midwest, is there any correlation between that drought and the possibilities of dry weather in the Midwest this summer?
So will dry weather creep eastward toward us? We've heard this one before, too. Mark, take the first part of the question about how many times you can kill a wheat crop.
Well, we do think that this dryness is going to continue in the southern plains. We've seen such low precip totals there over the past 4 or 5 months. In fact, there's some locations in western Oklahoma that have not had over a tenth of an inch in over 5 months, which is pretty much record. Those are record statistics of dryness across that area. And typically, when you've been that extremely dry, during even with these weak La Nina conditions and the expectations of a weak La Nina continuing here, we do think that this dryness is going to continue as we go on to the spring, growing season or the crop development cycle and heading and everything as we go through April and May. The second question, as far as the dryness creeping into the Midwest, or at least a correlation, we've never found any kind of correlation, at least between the Southern Plains rainfall and Midwestern rainfall. But that still is something to watch here with our La Nina variable, at least increasing the odds a little bit of dryness and heat this season. That's just something to watch here, but it's not really related to the Southern Plains dryness.
My comment on that second part is that from what I see in the weather patterns looking out the next month or so, and I don't go out as far as he does in forecasting, is that right now we see a little bit of a change in trend, I think, to wetter conditions than what we've had around the Midwest in the near term. Of course, when you go through an entire growing season, it comes down to the timeliness of rain, and whether we get creep of the dryness from there or not remains to be seen, at least on the short term. Now, long term, probably not, but 1 year where there was a problem was in 1980. That was a year in which it was very dry down that way and very hot, and we ended up having a little bit of a problem during a key part of the growing season in 1980. But every year is different. I'm not going to say, oh, here's 1980 all over again. In fact, I would probably I would say that it's very likely we'll have different conditions. Every year is unique. But it certainly, with any growing season, there's a possibility of a period of dry weather that could cause terrible problems for the crops if it just comes at that particular time when the crops are reproducing. Conversely, you could have a generally dry year, and if you get timely rains right during July and August, you can make a crop with an otherwise dry summer. So a lot of it does come down to the short-term weather trends as we go on through the growing season. So that goes back to your having to monitor AM580 and the web.
And even if I can add one quick comment, a great example of having a drier than normal season yet getting timely rains. That's exactly what happened across South America this season. When you look at your precip totals going back from when they started planting in Brazil and Argentina in October, November, actually your growing season ended up being, or at least through early March, actually had below normal precip totals. But those rains came exactly when they needed them, especially in Argentina and then some areas of southern Brazil there. Like, for example, we were going on 3 to 4 weeks without any rain across Argentina until early January came around. And then the spigots got turned on. They got 2, 3, 4, 5 inches of rain. They then went dry for 2 to 3 weeks, but those 4 or 5 inches of rain was enough to hold them over. And so just the timeliness, that's what's making another good crop down there.
Question in the room?
We've been talking about the weather here in the United States. However, China stopped exporting corn. At least there was an announcement to that effect, I think, last week. What are conditions there going to be like, and is there a place we can go to find out what's happening there? And a second part to that, you were talking about sea surface temperatures. Is all the bodies of water around the Earth all tending to warm together with just this minor aberration with a La Nina being the total exception, and are we seeing a trend that way?
Ed, you take the second part. You take the science part of the question, and we'll let Mark think about places to go for China conditions.
Oh, you want me to talk now about the global water? It's not warm everywhere. Yeah, I can tell you that. There's some cold water in spots. There's just certain areas that are affecting us right now that tend to be warmer than average. It's not a case of where the whole Earth's water is turned warm.
Let's talk about the water before we talk about Chinese weather. If you look at the North Atlantic and North Pacific, there has been some sort of decadal warming here over the past several decades. But it's been mainly confined to the North Atlantic. It has not been across the Southern Hemisphere bodies of water. And so I guess when you kind of average things out, our oceans have trended a little bit warmer, but it's been more in various areas of the globe or more regional rather than widespread here. And that also raises another point, which I'm not going to get into, but it always comes up that leads to a whole other discussion we can have another day with global warming.
Yeah, you had to
now that you talk about that global warming,
thanks.
But
Mark.
With the you're welcome. With certainly you've had this tendency both with air temperature and water temperature to warm in various areas of the globe here, and so. That then leads to our whole global warming debate and issue and that. But the bottom line is that certainly the warming that we've seen, it's been more regional from a water temperature standpoint rather than anything widespread, i.e. the whole ocean surfaces around the world on the increase.
China.
From a China standpoint, you're going to be planting here coming up in April. Their time frame is very similar to ours here in the U.S. Planting of corn commences in April, soybeans typically late April and on and through May. And the one thing, though, while their schedule of planting is similar to ours, it's a different climate. They have a distinct dry season and a rainy season, and right now they're in the midst of their dry season, and it seems to come up every single spring. Uh-oh, China's dry. It's always March, it's April, and I'm surprised I haven't heard it already, but you always hear around this time of year, China is dry. They're supposed to be dry. They have that's their climate over the winter. They have very low normal precipitation totals, and so at least going into this new growing season, they are dry, but normally dry. Actually, if you take a look at their rainfall totals over the past several months, it's actually they've had pretty much a normal dry season. So right where we stand right now, you're in pretty good shape here across China as we begin their growing season. Some of the colder areas or some of the areas up north, more of their big bean-producing area of like Heilongjiang province, way up there north in northeast China, those areas have been pretty cold of lately, so it might be a little bit slow going for their soil temperatures to warm up to support planting. But that would be the only thing to watch at this time.
Question in the room? No?
None.
No question in the room.
That one.
Up front here.
What do you foresee in the upcoming hurricane season?
I'll know more next week on that. I'm going to a conference the next few days where hurricanes will be discussed. It's very early to make a hurricane season forecast. I think it's safe to say there won't be as many named storms in the Atlantic Basin as last year, since the record was broken by 5 with 27 named storms. But I think there's still concern that it's going to be we're still in an active period. There's not much that's changed there. And when we talk about water temperatures being warmer than average, there's no switch to make it colder all of a sudden. And hurricanes develop over warm tropical waters, so the water's still running a little warmer than average. That means you have a little longer season, and you can also make storms more intense. I don't know if you have anything different to say about that.
No, we're expecting an active season, which mainly comes down to your water temperatures in the Atlantic being pretty similar to what we saw a year ago. The other kind of interesting item is that with our kind of weaker La Nina conditions, technically that should produce even actually better conditions here for tropical development compared to a normal sea surface temperature state, which is what we saw last season. But, you know, technically if you put all those technically, if you put everything together there, you should have another very active season. But as Ed mentioned, how can you repeat the record-breaking season of last year? And another item, too, is that you cannot predict at this time, you know, where are those storms going to form. You know, it's one thing when you have an active hurricane season, yet all your systems are out in the Atlantic and never make landfall. We've had that before. Kind of a good example, it was 1995. We had a very active season, which I don't know the exact number that made landfall, but obviously you had a very high number of storms, but no one can really recall what happened that season. While, you know, everyone will never forget the record-breaking season of 2005, especially with storms hitting, you know, the U.S. as major storms.
Of course, the opposite's true. You could have a quiet hurricane season in terms of number of storms. I recall 1992, the first named storm of the season was in late August. The storm's name was Andrew, and devastated South Florida. And that really was not an active season, but that was just one big one making a direct hit on a populated area. So a lot of it just is the randomness on landfall versus not landfall. But of course, when you have a season with 27 named storms, the likelihood of landfall being made is greater somewhere with some of them. And this year with the Gulf of Mexico being exceptionally warm, any storm that went into the Gulf explosively developed, and that's how we got Katrina and Rita and Wilma to cause so much damage.
Todd, you have a question.
On hurricanes, how much precipitation in the pattern do we normally get from them? And my question has more to do with the potential for rust spore showers as opposed to showers. So when they come in to the Gulf, do they follow a pattern after they hit the U.S. so that the counterclockwise you can say, well, it lands mostly in Ohio, further to the east? How often does it hit maybe Indiana, Illinois? Does Iowa ever get remnants of one of these storms?
Well, the farther east you get, the better the chance you have of picking up the remnants of a hurricane, because once storm makes landfall on the Gulf Coast and heads northward, it eventually turns eastbound. So Iowa this past season was not affected at all, really. But sometimes a remnant storm, usually one that would maybe go into Texas and take a long path winding around and then up north, would on occasion affect Iowa. So in the Midwest, the farther south and east you get, the better chance you have of picking up hurricane moisture. And this year we saw that in Illinois. Northern and western Illinois really didn't get much rain at all during the summer growing season, whereas southeastern Illinois, some locations got heavy rains from Arlene and Dennis and Katrina. And I know Rita affected parts of the Midwest farther to the east as well. So the odds are the farther east and south you get, the greater your chance of picking up moisture and wind from a hurricane.
We have a question in the front of the room.
Yeah, does it make a difference what side of the Appalachians it gets on? Don't if it gets on the east side, where it's probably not going to get in the Midwest. If it gets on the west side, while Indiana and Ohio and Crawford County, Illinois might get a little.
Well, certainly if it goes up the east coast on the east side of the Appalachians, it's farther away from us too, and the mountains tend to maybe act as a little of a buffer, although I've seen some remnants go kind of right up the mountain chain and cause then you start hearing about some horrific flooding, because you fill up the valleys in between the mountains, and a lot of times you end up with some big problems in West Virginia and Pennsylvania and states near there.
Yeah, really all, it's actually more random. It's really just depending on what your jet stream pattern is at the time that you have the storm. And, you know, even you look at with our storms this past season, or even for that matter, two seasons ago where Florida on the southeast got hit, you do tend to, when you get in one area for the season, that typically tends to be your area, but give or take, you know, several hundred miles either side. But it really all comes down to your jet stream pattern at the time.
We're just about out of time, and I'd like to end this panel this way, because, fellas, it's not that often you get to speak live before a room of about 225 producers. So with that opportunity, I'd like to just throw it open to you in an open sort of way about what are the most important things that you could leave with these people, something that they can take with them home and have as a piece of knowledge that can help them out in their operations.
Well, I'll start off here. I guess a few things to keep a close eye on here as we go through the next several months and throughout the growing season. Well, number one, monitoring conditions in the hard red winter wheat belt. Obviously, we've seen a big rally already and a lot of concern about winter wheat in the southern plains, and that's already become extremely weather sensitive. I know the markets have moved a lot lately on various weather forecasts out there, but certainly we need to keep an eye on that, which it's going to be with us here for the next several months as we've now going through spring growth, and that'll continue here over the next several months with then harvesting taking place in June. The other items here is that for this growing season here, well, once again, I just want to point out that, you know, just this whole La Nina story that's being talked about quite a bit, don't put too much faith in it, because once again, it's just one of many variables out there that dictate your weather patterns. But I think already there's been a lot of talk about, you know, this is the big drought year because of the impending La Nina. But you know, it all comes down to, as Ed said before, a timeliness of rains. And certainly if we get off to a good start here, come April and May, you know, typically when you start off this great across the Midwest, when you get the crops in early, then typically that's when you have your best seasons.
Ed?
Well, I agree with all the comments Mark made, and I think therefore it comes down to having to do a little bit of work, unfortunately, and that means paying attention to some of the things he mentioned, such as the dryness in the southern plains and not believing the La Nina equals this because it's just one of many variables. And really, when you get down to it, the atmosphere is complicated. You can look at the big trend, but you also have to look at the short-term timeliness of rains. And that means having to pay attention to the weather. And I think at WILL, we do a great job of trying to keep you informed, not only with the daily forecast that we provide in the morning. Most of the time, it's Mike Sola or it's me. And then also in the afternoons, Mark Russo and John Davis on Monday afternoons. And we also have Drew Lerner and Don Day and Peter Levitt and Steve Hilberg along to give you different viewpoints on what different agricultural meteorologists are saying. So to be successful, it does take some work. I think everybody that comes here knows that. So if there's any piece of advice I can give you leaving here today is just pay attention to the weather. And also another thing.
Especially on Monday afternoons.
Yes.
At 2:32.
2:32.
Central time.
But the thing is, whenever you make it, whether it's a long-term decision where you might hedge toward a dry season versus a wet, you don't want to throw all your eggs in one basket, but you also want to think about the other side. What could possibly go the other way? What are the chances of that? So that you keep an open mind. Don't have your mindset all in one direction, because if there's anything experience has told me is that we do get surprised, and quite often, and I can guarantee you right now, if we were to come back in August, something's going to happen meteorologically here in the Midwest that none of us, and no forecaster I know, even has a hint of happening. There's surprises every year, and some of those surprises we get a little lead time on, but every year is different, and you just have to continue to follow the weather on a daily and weekly basis to make your best decisions.
AM 580 Chief Meteorologist Ed Kuser and Mark Russo of Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois. Give them a hand, please.